Usually when we think about scoring a goal in hockey, there's this expectation of just brute force.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, like a medieval siege.
Right. You just bombard the castle walls. I mean, the idea is you get pucks to the net, you crash the crease, throw bodies at the problem, and eventually, well, the wall just breaks.
Yeah, that's the cliche everyone grows up with.
Exactly. So welcome to this deep dive. Today, our mission is to completely redefine what you think the ultimate goal is when your team actually has the puck in the offensive zone.
And we have a really massive stack of sources to get through today to help us do that.
We really do. We're looking at expected goals models spanning, a decade of NHL data. Plus, we have these manual tracking projects documenting tens of thousands of passes.
Yeah, and we're also pulling from tactical breakdowns by analysts like Greg Refak.
Right. And get this, we're even going to dig deep into the actual physical rule books from the NHL and USA Hockey.
Which is going to be wild. It's a fascinating collection of material because it takes something that looks like pure chaos on television and reveals this underlying machinery.
Yeah, because when you watch a game, I mean, it just looks like 10 skaters flying around at 30 miles an hour.
Exactly. But the data and the tactical models we are going to unpack today, they show that offensive zone play is actually a highly structured, almost surgical environment.
So I want to challenge the most common misconception right out of the gate based on these sources. If you are listening to this, whether you're a player, a coach, or just a diehard fan, your goal in the offensive zone is not simply to shoot the puck.
Right, which sounds completely counterintuitive to most people.
It really does. You win by scoring and you score by shooting. So, I mean, how can the goal not be the shot?
Well, I look at it as a matter of redefining the finish line.
Yeah.
If you only remember one overarching concept to start us off today, let it be this.
Okay, lay it on us.
Once you have the puck at the other team's end of the ice, you are not trying to take a shot. You are trying to take a shot from a dangerous place while the goalie is moving.
Ah, okay. The context matters.
Huge difference, yeah. Almost any team, even at the amateur level, can get the puck into the offensive zone and flip it toward the net. But everything a truly elite team does, like cycling along the boards, the intricate passing, the battles in front of the net, it's just machinery.
Machinery designed to do what exactly?
Designed to produce one single, highly specific moment. A shot from a dangerous piece of ice with a goalie who is caught out of position.
Okay, so as a player, you really only have two fundamental levers you can pull to manufacture that specific moment.
Exactly two levers.
Right. So lever number one is moving the puck to a dangerous place. You carry it there, you pass it there, or you physically drive it there before you finally decide to pull the trigger.
And lever number two is moving the goalie so that a shot from virtually anywhere suddenly becomes dangerous.
How do you do that without the puck?
Well, you take away their eyes with a physical screen, or you force them to slide laterally with a pass across the middle of the ice. Or, you make them commit their weight forward to deal with a rebound.
And I imagine the absolute best scoring chances do both of those things.
Oh, absolutely. The ones that consistently light the lamp at the professional level do both at the exact same time. You change the angle of the puck to a high danger area while simultaneously forcing the goaltender to reset their entire physical posture.
But I really have to push back here for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
Because I'm thinking about every hockey coach I have ever had, right? And every broadcast I have ever listened to. The classic cliche is just get pucks to the net.
Pucks deep, pucks to the net. Yep.
Coaches scream it from the bench constantly. So, is volume shooting really a bad strategy? I mean, think about it like buying lottery tickets.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
Right. If I buy one ticket, my odds are terrible. If I buy 100 tickets, eventually I have to hit the jackpot, right? Aren't we just playing the numbers game by throwing everything at the net?
That lottery analogy is interesting, but the data suggests it is fundamentally flawed in this context.
Why is that?
Because you aren't buying 100 lottery tickets. You're basically handing your wallet to the dealer and walking away.
Wow. Okay, that's a bleak picture.
It is. The expected goals models we are looking at completely debunk the volume strategy. For instance, Micah Blake-McCurdy has mapped a decade of NHL data.
A full decade.
Yeah, we were talking from 2007 all the way to 2017. He looked at even strength play, and the numbers are staggering. The goals per unblocked shot from outside the dangerous areas of the ice are under 5%.
Wait, let me make sure I am grasping the scale of that. Under 5%.
Less than 5%, yes.
So if a team just sets up on the perimeter and fires away, 95 times out of 100, nothing productive happens.
Actually, It is worse than that when you read the metric literally.
How could it be worse?
Well, that metric is unblocked shots. It's not standard shooting percentage. An unblocked shot includes goals, sure, but it also includes saves by the goalie, and it includes complete misses.
Oh, like hitting the post or missing the net entirely?
Right, or ringing it off the glass. The misses are baked right into the math. So when you shoot from the outside, you have a less than 5% chance of scoring, but a massive probability of either giving the goalie an easy freeze for a whistle or just missing the net and rimming the puck all the way out of the zone.
Which effectively just ends your own possession.
Exactly. Volume from the perimeter isn't a strategic plan. It's what a team defaults to when they lack a plan.
Okay, and point shots, specifically like shots taken by the defenseman way up at the blue line, they're even less effective, according to the sources.
Yeah, they highlight Greg Rivak's figures for this.
Now, they do note we should treat these as illustrative directions rather than ironclad stats, but still, the picture they paint is pretty bleak. Point shots convert at about 3% if there is heavy traffic in front of the net.
And without traffic.
They convert at 1% or less.
Yeah, a 1% conversion rate is essentially a rounding error.
Yeah.
I mean, if you are a defenseman and you fire a puck from the blue line with absolutely nobody standing in front of the goaltender to screen their vision, you're not generating offense.
You're just giving it away.
You're turning the puck over with extra steps. You are basically handing the puck to the goalie and ask them to set up their team's breakout.
So what does this all mean for our mental model as we go through this deep dive? It means that to understand where we actually should shoot from, we first have to map out the geography of danger on the ice.
Right, because if the perimeter is a dead zone, we need to know where the life is.
Exactly, and that brings us to a concept the sources call home plate. Let's build this map for the listener so they can picture it.
To visualize home plate, imagine you are looking down at the attacking half of the rink. Draw a horizontal line straight across the ice, connecting the tops of the two face-off circles.
Okay, got it.
Then, from the edges of that line, run two vertical lines straight down the sides of the circles to the face-off dots.
Down to the dots.
Finally, from those two dots, angle the lines sharply inward to meet at the two goalposts.
So if you draw that out in your head, it literally looks exactly like home plate in baseball, just scaled way up to cover the slot.
Precisely. Shots taken from anywhere inside that specific geometric polygon are officially tracked by data providers as scoring chances.
And if you penetrate even deeper into the inner part of that plate, like close to the net, right between the face-off dots,
those are classified as high danger chances. SportLogic data, which uses advanced optical tracking to monitor player and puck movement, actually shows that getting just 10 feet closer to the net can dramatically multiply your chances of scoring.
Just 10 feet makes that much of a difference.
Huge difference. Moving from the top of the plate to the inner slot makes a clean, unobstructed look from the low slot worth several times more in expected goal value than an unscreened shot from the blue line.
But there is a geographic concept in these sources that is arguably even more crucial than home plate. It is something called the Royal Road.
Yes. The Royal Road is critical.
Now, I had heard this term thrown around in broadcasts, but seeing the math behind it changes everything.
It's fascinating because unlike the blue line or the face-off circles, the Royal Road isn't painted on the ice. It is an entirely imaginary line.
So where is it?
It runs lengthwise down the absolute dead center of the rink, stretching from the middle of one net all the way to the middle of the other. It effectively chops the ice into a left half and a right half.
Okay, and according to the data, passing the puck across this imaginary center line is basically the holy grail of offensive hockey.
It really is. Our sources cite Alan Wells, who conducted an extensive analysis of Ryan Stimson's passing project data.
I want to pause here and explain what the source is to the listener, because it is just incredible. This wasn't just a computer spitting out algorithms, right?
No, not at all. This was a massive volunteer-led initiative. People manually tracked over 51,000 passes leading up to shots during 5-on-5 play.
51,000 manual tracks. That is dedication.
It is. They wanted to see not just where shots came from, but what kind of passes preceded those shots.
And what did they find?
They found that a pass that crosses the Royal Road immediately before a shot is taken, often called a cross slot or seam pass, converts at 15.50%.
Wait, 15.50%?
Yes.
Yeah.
And to put that 15.50% into perspective, That is roughly double the conversion rate of the very next best pass type they measured.
Double the value. That is an astronomical leap in probability.
It really is. It's the most valuable thing you can do.
But this is what I want to dig into. Why? I mean, I love understanding the physical mechanisms behind the numbers. Why is crossing that specific imaginary line in the middle of the ice the absolute worst nightmare for a goaltender?
To understand the why, we really have to look at the biomechanics of goaltending.
Okay, let's break it down.
A modern goalie's save is almost entirely about positioning and geometry, not raw reflexes. If a goalie is set, square to the shooter, and have their depth established, they are already covering the vast majority of the net before the puck even leaves the stick.
Right, the puck essentially just hits them.
Exactly. But when an attacking player makes a pass across the Royal Road, they force that goaltender to abandon their perfect geometry and execute four incredibly difficult jobs simultaneously. They have to do it in a fraction of a second.
Okay, let's slow time down here and break those four jobs apart for the listener. The pass leaves the blade on the left side of the ice and heads toward the right. What happens to the goalie?
Well, job number one, the goalie has to physically push laterally across the crease to re-square their shoulders and chest to the new position of the puck.
Makes sense. What's job two?
Job number two, as they are sliding laterally, they also have to re-establish their depth and angle to cut off the new shooting lane. This requires backward or forward movement on top of that lateral push.
That sounds physically exhausting. Job three.
Job three is visual. They have to visually re-find the puck. When a pass goes through the slot, it usually travels through a forest of skates and sticks, right?
Oh, true. So they lose sight of it.
Exactly. Their sight line is shattered, and they have to pick the puck up again in flight.
And the final job.
Job number four. They have to reset their own stick and pads to seal the ice upon arrival at the new post.
Okay, I am picturing a tennis player.
A tennis player.
Yeah, imagine a tennis player who has just sprinted all the way to the left baseline to return a really tough shot. They plant their feet, but instantly the opponent smashes the ball directly back to the far right corner.
Oh, I see.
Their momentum is going left, their weight is distributed wrong, and their mechanics are just completely destroyed as they try to reverse direction.
That analogy captures the panic perfectly, honestly. Because the goaltender is forced to move so frantically to cover the distance, technical errors inevitably creep into their form.
Like what kind of errors?
Well, as they push across, the five hole between their legs frequently opens up. Their arms might trail behind their body, exposing the corners.
And if your shot arrives before they fix that?
If your shot arrives at the net before the goalie can finish that complex four-step sequence, they aren't making a controlled positioning save anymore. They're making a desperate scrambling save, and desperation is where goals are scored.
So we know the math. We know we want to cross the Royal Road, but practically speaking, how do we actually create that pass in a live game?
That's the challenge, right?
Yeah, because the defense knows this rule too. Their entire system is designed to pack the middle of the ice.
Very true. But the sources give us a very specific scanning habit to overcome this.
Let's do some active retrieval here for the listener. If you are playing and you receive the puck on the boards, where is the very first place your eyes should go?
Your very first visual scan must be to the far side of the slot. You're looking at the back door and the weak side faceoff dot. You must look across the middle of the ice before you look up the wall.
Which is the exact opposite of what most amateur players do. I mean, the instinct is to look up the wall because it's safe and it's right in front of you.
It is the safe option, but it is a total trap. The window for a Royal Road pass is measured in fractions of a second.
So if you hesitate, it's gone.
Yep. If you look at your defenseman on the safe side of the wall first, and then you scan the middle, the seam across the slot will have already opened and permanently closed. You have to read the most dangerous option first.
And if you decide to make that pass?
You pass to where the shooter is going, not where they currently are. That way they can one-time the puck without taking an extra touch that would allow the goalie to get set.
Okay, so knowing where the dangerous ice is, mapping out home plate and the Royal Road, that's step one.
Yeah.
But you don't play hockey in a vacuum.
No, you have four teammates on the ice with you.
Exactly. So how do we organize our five players to consistently attack this invisible geometry?
That brings us to the structure of the attack. The sources refer to this as building the five-man machine, and it relies heavily on a concept called the attack triangle.
Let's lay the groundwork by defining the roles first, F1, F2, and F3.
So the most vital thing to understand here is that F1, F2, and F3 are not fixed positions.
Wait, they aren't?
No, they are temporary roles based entirely on arrival order. It absolutely does not matter if the program says you are the center or the left winger.
Interesting.
If a puck gets dumped into the corner and you are the first player in a jersey of your color to arrive at that puck, congratulations, you are F1.
So it's just a race.
Basically.
Yeah.
The second player to arrive to support you is F2. And the last forward to enter the zone is F3.
I can really see how that causes confusion for beginners. You know, you grow up thinking, well, I am the center, I stay in the middle.
Right, but in the modern offensive zone, these roles rotate constantly. However, while the specific players swap roles, the physical shape they form on the ice must remain rigid.
Okay, so what is that shape?
The shape is a structured below level above triangle. Let's say F1 has the puck on the sideboards. F2 needs to get below the pick.
Meaning closer to the goal line.
Exactly. Deeper toward the goal line than the puck carrier. This creates a safety outlet if F1 gets pressured. At the same time, you want an option level with the puck for close support, perhaps for a quick bump pass.
And what about F3?
Crucially, F3 must stay above the puck, higher up in the zone toward the blue line. F3 serves as a high shooting option, and most importantly, as the defensive safety net in case of a turnover.
So this creates that attack triangle. Why is this specific geometric shape so effective at breaking down a defense?
Because it mathematically guarantees that the puck carrier has at least two passing options at completely different angles at all times.
So the defender has to choose.
Right. It forces the defending player to respect both the width and the depth of the ice. If a defender attacks the puck carrier, they know they are leaving an outlet open.
And as the puck moves around the zone,
the three forwards move in synchronization to preserve that exact triangle shape. It is a living, breathing geometric formation.
But there is a massive caveat in the sources here, a non-negotiable rule regarding where this triangle can actually exist.
Yes. At least one of those three forwards must always be physically inside or actively attacking the home plate area.
Because otherwise,
if your entire attack triangle is floating on the perimeter near the boards, you aren't threatening anything. You are just cleanly executing passes around the outside of a perfectly happy, comfortable defensive box.
It's back to that siege mentality we mentioned earlier. You're just throwing pebbles at a reinforced wall.
Exactly.
Now, we've talked about the forwards. What about the defensemen? Where do they fit into this five-man machine?
Defensemen in the offensive zone operate at three very specific depths. The first depth is the point, which is their default home base.
And where exactly is that?
To play the point correctly, you do not stand directly on the painted blue line. You stand one full aggressive stride inside the blue line.
Why inside?
It ensures you can keep the puck in the zone while remaining the primary outlet, a long-range shooting threat, and the ultimate safety net against a breakaway counterattack.
Okay, that's the default. What is the second depth?
The second depth is called activated. This occurs when a defenseman sees an opening and steps down from the blue line to the top of the face-off circles.
So they move in closer to shoot.
Yes. You activate to shoot from a significantly better angle or to receive a pass in the high slot. The key here is that you are still recoverable. From the top of the circles, if the puck turns over, you can still pivot and sprint back to defend.
Got it. And the third depth. The sources ominously label it too deep.
Too deep is exactly what it sounds like. It is when a defenseman drives down below the hash marks near the face-off dots or the corners.
Oh, wow. That's far.
If you go below the hash marks, you're no longer playing defense. You're effectively playing as a fourth forward. It is a massive high-risk commitment.
I want to paint a picture for the listener here. Let's predict what happens when this goes wrong. A defenseman dives deep below the hash marks, thinking they can pinch and steal the puck.
Okay, picture it.
But the opposing winger chips it past them. Suddenly, that defenseman is trapped in the corner. I think of a goalie in soccer.
How so?
Imagine a soccer goalie sprinting all the way out to midfield to intercept a breakaway. If they get the ball, great highlight. But if they miss, the net is completely empty, and the opposing team is running full speed the other way. The panic from the rest of the team must be palpable.
It is the exact same feeling of impending doom. A defenseman missing a deep pinch is the primary genesis of odd man rushes. We're talking two-on-ones and breakaways against your own goalie.
So what's the golden rule if they do end up down there?
The golden rule of playing too deep is this. If you go down there and you do not secure the puck, your only job in the world is to recover defensively.
You don't try to make up for it.
No, you do not chase a failed activation around the net. You turn and sprint back to your position. Furthermore, the machine requires balance. If a defenseman activates or goes deep, F3, that high forward in the triangle, must possess the spatial awareness to immediately drop back and fill in at the blue line.
And the sources are really emphatic about communication here. They literally say, say it out loud.
Yes, absolutely.
You have to yell, I'm going, and F3 has to yell back, I've got you. If you rely on silent rotations, you know, you are going to leave the blue line completely empty and the other team is going to walk away with a breakaway.
Exactly. Communication is the tether that keeps the machine together.
Okay, so we have established our attack triangle. We have our defensemen managing their depths. But what happens when we do all of this perfectly, but the defense is just completely dialed in?
It happens all the time.
Right. They are packed tight. They are blocking the Royal Road. And we simply cannot find that cross slot pass. What is the next lever?
When you can't strike quickly, you have to grind them down. That is when a team initiates the cycle.
The cycle. This is the heavy lifting, the mechanics of the grind. Let's define exactly what a cycle is for someone who might just see a scrum on the boards.
Sure. A cycle is when the forwards continually rotate around the low offensive zone, using the corners, the half wall, and the space behind the net. They move the puck in very short distances, protecting it with their bodies and constantly trading places.
It looks a bit like a wheel slowly turning along the perimeter boards. You know, you are moving the puck a few feet at a time, establishing body position, and just waiting.
That's a great visual, yeah.
But why does this actually work? Because compared to the speed and flash of a rush attack, the cycle feels agonizingly slow.
It works entirely through cognitive and physical exhaustion.
Exhaustion.
Oh, yeah. Defensively, playing against a heavy cycle is a nightmare. Every single time the attacking forwards rotate positions, it forces the defenders to rapidly reevaluate their assignments.
So they have to keep thinking.
Exactly. The defender is constantly asking themselves, do I collapse low to chase the puck carrier, or do I hold my ground to protect the slot? If you force an opposing player to make that high-stress decision 30 or 40 times in the single shift, eventually they will guess wrong.
They will chase when they shouldn't, and a seam will open up.
Exactly. And there's a massive physical toll, too. The defending players are playing reactive hockey, stopping and starting without the puck, which burns a tremendous amount of energy.
And because your team is possessing the puck, the defending team cannot safely change their players. They get trapped out there.
Right. And tired coverage almost always shrinks inward toward the puck like a dying star. And when the defense shrinks toward the corners, the high slot is suddenly wide open.
The cycle is also heavily favored in risk management, isn't it?
Very much so. It is a very low-risk way to hold possession while you wait for a mistake. If you try to force a hero pass through the middle of the ice and it gets intercepted, you immediately create an odd man rush going the other way while all your forwards are trapped deep.
But a short pass along the boards.
It's cheap to miss. If it fails or gets bobbled, the puck just stays pinned near the wall with bodies swarming it. You live to fight another second.
Okay, let's get into the micromechanics of the cycle. I really love this part of the material. There are two key reads a player has to make when they are battling on the wall.
The rim and the reverse.
Yes. Walk us through the step-by-step logic here.
It is entirely predicated on reading the opposing checker's momentum. Let's say you have the puck on the sideboards. You look up, and a defender is bearing down on you.
Okay, coming fast.
If the checker is still physically in front of you, maintaining their defensive side and trying to seal you against the wall, you execute a rim.
A rim? What does that look like?
You push the puck onward, hard around the curve of the boards, past the checker's stick, to your teammate who is arriving behind the net. You're essentially going with the natural flow of the play.
Okay, so that's if they are staying in front of me. But what if the defender gets too aggressive? What if they come flying in way too fast and overcommit?
That is when you deploy the reverse. If the checker has skated too fast and their momentum carries them past your body toward the end boards, think about the ice they just left.
It's empty.
Right. The space behind them is now completely vacant. So instead of forcing the puck forward into their skates, you pass the puck backward against the flow of the play into that empty space you just created.
And someone will be there.
Your F2 teammate should be arriving right behind you on the half wall to pick it up cleanly.
So the mental heuristic is actually really simple. If the checker is front, rim. If the checker is past you, reverse.
Exactly. And if you misread their momentum and get it wrong, you just handed the puck directly to their stick.
Now, I want to talk about the physical reality of these board battles. If I have the puck on the boards and a 220-pound defender is coming to hit me, human instinct screams at me to turn my back to them.
Oh, for sure. Face the glass and turtle up.
Right. face the glass, turtle up to protect the puck with my body. But the sources are clear that this is a terrible idea. Why shouldn't I turn my back to protect the puck?
For two reasons, one relating to safety and the other to strategy. First, never turn your back to the boards and never duck your head.
Because of the injury risk?
Yes. That is the quickest way to sustain a severe neck or spinal injury in hockey. If you are facing the glass and get hit from behind, you have nowhere to go but head first into the boards.
And the strategic reason?
Second, turning your back completely kills your mobility and your vision. You can no longer see the ice, meaning you can't find that rim or reverse option. You have blinded yourself.
So what is the correct physical technique to absorb that pressure?
You have to keep your skates parallel to the wall in a staggered stance. When the contact comes, you lean your forearm and your hip into the defender.
So don't use your shoulder.
No, you do not absorb it with the point of your shoulder, which can cause separation. Keep your head up, chin off your chest, and scan the ice.
But if I'm stationary, I'm just going to get pinned.
Exactly, which is why your feet must be constantly moving, even just chopping the ice. If your feet are moving and your hips are parallel to the wall, you maintain the leverage to spin off the contact, protect the puck, and make a play.
That is such a vital micro skill. But zooming back out to the macro level of the cycle, we have to talk about its ultimate failure state. What is the worst thing a team can do while cycling?
The worst thing a team can do is cycle for its own sake.
Yes. You see this all the time. Three or four beautiful, perfectly orchestrated rotations. The rim is clean, the reverse is crisp, the team looks like a machine.
But they never actually threaten the net.
Right. They just burn 30 to 45 seconds of their own offensive shift for the defense at absolutely zero risk to the opposing goaltender.
We have to remember the core premise we started with. A cycle is a setup mechanism. It is not an outcome. The goal is not to see how long you can hold the puck on the boards.
The goal is to force a mistake that opens the slot. Let's pause for a moment. If you are listening to this, you know, whether you are on your commute or at the gym, I want you to think about your own games or the NHL games you watch on TV. Based on what we just discussed, how do you know definitively that a cycle has failed?
A cycle has failed if the shift ends and the puck never went above the goal line, never hit the middle of the ice, and absolutely nobody on your team was standing in front of the opposing net.
So if you're just on the perimeter.
If you are executing a perfect perimeter cycle without attacking the paint, you are merely passing the puck around the outside of a defensive box that has absolutely no reason to break its structure. You are doing the defense's job for them.
Speaking of getting the puck above the goal line, when the cycle inevitably gets stuck low and the defense has collapsed tightly around the net like a turtle in its shell, you need a pressure release.
You definitely do.
The best relief valve in this situation is the low-to-high play.
Low-to-high refers to passing the puck from the deep corner or the half wall all the way up to the defenseman stationed at the point.
Right, but it is vital to understand that this play requires precise orchestration from all five players. It is not just a blind panic pass backward to escape pressure.
No, let's break down the sequence of this machinery step by step. Step one, the forward on the wall passes the puck up to the point, but they don't just stand there and watch.
What do they do?
The passer immediately has to skate up to support the hash marks. They become a bailout option if the defenseman gets in trouble, or they prepare to hunt a long rebound.
Okay, step two, the defenseman receives the puck. What is their immediate non-negotiable job?
The defenseman must walk the line toward the middle of the ice before they even think about shooting.
Why is walking the line so critical? If the point shot is already a low percentage play, shouldn't they just catch it and fire as fast as possible to surprise the goalie?
Absolutely not. A stationary defenseman is shooting directly into a stationary wall of shin pads. By catching the puck and taking two or three explosive lateral strides toward the absolute center of the blue line, you accomplish three things.
Let's hear them.
First, you drastically change the geometric angle of the shot. Second, you force the goaltender to track you laterally, which we know introduces errors.
And the third.
Third, and most importantly, you force the defending forwards who are trying to block the shot to move their feet. When a shot blocker shifts their weight laterally, passing and shooting lanes temporarily open up between their legs and sticks.
Okay, so the defenseman is walking the line. Step three, one forward must immediately sprint to the net front to establish a screen. Step four, another forward slides into the high slot to create a supportive triangle with the point man. The machine is fully engaged.
But I want to revisit a seemingly contradictory point we made earlier.
You mean the conversion statistics?
Exactly.
Right. We noted that point shots convert at a dismal 1 to 3%. At even strength, they are mathematically among the lowest percentage, least valuable shots on the entire ice surface, and they are blocked at a higher rate than any other attempt.
So the obvious question is,
if point shots are so mathematically terrible, why are we designing an entire complex five-man set play to manufacture them?
It is a brilliant question, and the answer is that the point shot itself is not the end goal.
It's not.
No. Yeah. When a defenseman shoots from the blue line, the objective is rarely to score a clean goal directly on the initial shot. You are using that low percentage shot as the raw material to generate a secondary event.
Like a rebound.
You are trying to create a rebound, a tip, a chaotic scramble in the crease, or at the very least, a whistle that results in an offensive zone faceoff. The point shot is just a delivery mechanism designed to create utter chaos inside home plate.
Here's a stark reality check that crystallizes this idea. If I am a defenseman and I look up and there is absolutely no one from my team standing in front of the goaltender to create that chaos, I should not shoot the puck.
No, you shouldn't.
Let's use an analogy. It feels like a quarterback in football throwing a 60-yard Hail Mary pass into an end zone where none of his receivers are standing.
That analogy is spot on. A point shot with no traffic in front of the goalie is nothing more than a giveaway with extra steps. You are providing the goalie with an incredibly easy, confidence-building save, and worse, you are likely handing the opposing team a clean breakout opportunity.
The sources actually provide a really illuminating cautionary case study on this exact phenomenon, don't they?
They do. We can look at the Seattle Kraken during their inaugural 2021-22 season. According to manual tracking compiled by Corey Snager and expected value data analyzed by Jay Fresh Hockey, the Kraken generated the third most point shots in the entire NHL that year.
Third most point shots. So they were executing the pucks to the net philosophy flawlessly.
On the surface, yes. But because they lacked elite net front presence and relied on safe perimeter passing rather than penetrating the Royal Road, they produced the lowest expected value per shot of any team in the league.
They were shooting constantly, but from areas where the goalie could see everything. It was pure volume, completely devoid of quality. They were buying the lottery tickets and losing every time. So the ultimate takeaway here is that to make a point shot a viable strategic option, the net front player has to do their job flawlessly.
If the net front player fails, the defenseman's shot is wasted.
And this is where the physical bruising art of the game collides with an absolute minefield of a rule book.
The net front. This is where offensive plays go to finish. It requires immense bravery, perfect technique, and a bizarrely intimate knowledge of legal precedent.
Let's master the physical art of the screen first. If I am the designated net front player, where exactly should I stand? Do I want to be touching the goalie to annoy them?
No, you want to live just beyond the arc of the crease. You should stand outside the blue paint, roughly 6 to 8 feet out from the goal line, staying inside the width of the faceoff dots.
Why not get closer?
If you get too close to the goalie, they can just use their stick to push you out of the way or look right over your shoulder. If you are 6 to 8 feet out, you are close enough to tip the puck, but far enough away that the goalie cannot physically manipulate you.
And what about my alignment? The instinct is to stand dead center, right between the goalie and the middle of the net.
That is a common beginner mistake. You do not stand between the goalie and the net.
So where do I stand?
You stand directly between the goalie's eyes and the puck.
Yeah.
This is exactly why, when we discussed the defenseman walking the blue line, it is so critical that the net front player slides laterally in unison with them.
Oh, because if they move?
Right. If the defenseman moves the puck 10 feet to the right and you stay standing in the middle of the ice, you are no longer a screen. You are just a spectator wearing a jersey.
Yeah.
The goalie can see the puck perfectly. You must maintain the eclipse.
Wow. Posture matters just as much as geometry here. The sources outline a very specific physical stance. Your chest must be tall and square to the shooter. Your hips need to be dropped low, with your knees deeply bent. It is a squat, not a bow.
Yes.
Let's unpack the physics of that.
It is entirely about maintaining your center of gravity while maximizing your visual obstruction. If you stand straight up with locked knees, a defending defenseman will simply shove you in the lower back and you will topple over effortlessly.
Because you have no anchor.
Right. Conversely, if you fold at the waist and bow forward like you're touching your toes, you shrink your body profile significantly, and the goalie will just track the puck right over your back.
So what's the perfect posture?
You want a tall, proud chest to completely block the goalie's field of vision, combined with a low, wide base in your hips and legs to anchor yourself to the ice against cross-checks.
And there is one more crucial psychological element. You must be completely still upon the puck's release. If you are shuffling your feet or waving your stick wildly right as the shot is taken, you are giving the goaltender strobe-light flashes of the puck through your legs.
Be a brick wall. And furthermore, do not tune your head to watch the shot come in.
Right. Look at the puck through your legs or peek over your shoulder, but keep your chest facing out. If you turn your body around to watch the puck fly toward the net, you just turn sideways and unscreen the goalie at the most critical moment.
Exactly. And once the shot has passed you, we enter the physics of the tip.
The tip is an art form. The first rule, keep your blade flat on the ice. Most tippable pucks come in at ankle height.
They do. And the most important mental shift is realizing that you are merely redirecting the puck's existing energy. You are not swinging at it like a golf club or a baseball bat.
Just a slight angle change.
A microscopic 10 to 30 degree change in the puck's trajectory is more than enough to completely destroy a goaltender's mathematical read on the shot. You want to use soft hands.
Soft hands? What does that mean in this context?
You grip the stick loosely enough to absorb the puck's impact slightly. If you grip your stick with a death grip and swing at a slap shot, you are just going to ramp the puck straight up into the safety netting, out of play.
And if the tip doesn't go in, we have to deal with the rebound. Let's talk about the math of rebounds, because it is punishing.
It really is. According to Greg Rivak's breakdown of Alex Novette's charting data, the defending team recovers roughly 60% of all rebounds.
60%. That means the odds are inherently stacked against the offensive team, even if they execute everything perfectly.
Which is exactly why you can only win the race to a rebound by being physically present before the shot is ever taken.
Oh, because if you wait to see it.
If you stand on the perimeter, wait to see the shot, observe that there is a rebound, and then decide to crash the net, you have already lost.
Yeah.
The defense is closer, and they have inside leverage.
So you have to anticipate.
Furthermore, elite net front players anticipate tendencies. They know that a low shot to the goalie's leg pads will usually squirt aggressively back to the corner it originated from.
And what about the blocker side?
They know a shot to the blocker will deflect out to the offside of the ice. And they know a shot square to the chest usually drops dead right in the blue paint. They aren't reacting to the puck. They are skating to where the physics dictate the puck will be.
Okay, so we know how to anchor a screen, how to angle a tip, and how to mathematically hunt rebounds. Now we have to talk about why you might execute all of that absolutely flawlessly, score a highlight reel goal, and still hear the referee's whistle blow to wave it off.
Yes, the rule book.
It is time for a deep dive into the rule book, because what blew my mind reading these sources is that the concept of interference means wildly, fundamentally different things depending on what league you happen to play in.
It is without a doubt the most misunderstood area of offensive play, both by players and by fans screaming at the television.
Let's start with the most basic concept, crease violations.
Under the NHL rulebook and the IIHF rules governing international play, specifically Rule 69, setting a screen from outside the goal crease, provided there is no physical contact with the goalie, is perfectly legal.
Even if you block their vision entirely.
You can stand 1 millimeter away from the blue paint and completely block the goalie's view of the universe, and it is a good hockey play.
But what happens if the play is chaotic? I am jockeying for position with a defender, and my skate physically touches the blue paint of the crease.
In the NHL, a goal is disallowed if an attacking player establishes a significant position within the goal crease that both obstructs the goalie's vision and impairs their physical ability to defend the net.
Significant position. That sounds subjective.
It is a subjective phrase, but it generally means a substantial part of your body is planted inside the paint for more than an instantaneous fraction of a second.
So if I'm cutting across the crease and my toe drags through the paint for a split second right as the puck goes in, the NHL usually won't void the goal because I didn't establish a significant lasting position.
Generally, yes, it will count.
But wait, let's switch gears. What if I'm not in the NHL? What if I am playing in a local amateur league governed by USA Hockey or Hockey Canada?
That is where the trap snaps shut. USA Hockey Rule 625 takes a draconian approach.
How draconian?
It flatly bars a goal if an attacking player is positioned in the goal crease, period. There is no requirement for physical contact and no requirement that you impair the goalie's vision. If you are in the paint, the goal does not count.
Wow.
And here is the true nightmare scenario. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada define the painted red line itself that outlines the crease as being part of the crease.
Whoa, let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. The blue paint is the crease. The red line borders the blue paint. If my skate blade is entirely outside the blue paint, but is merely touching the 2-inch painted red line.
Under USA Hockey rules, you are legally inside the crease.
That's crazy.
And it gets worse. If your team possesses the puck in the offensive zone, and you are simply standing on that red line, the referee can blow an immediate whistle for a crease violation and force a face-off outside the offensive zone.
You can literally lose your team's entire offensive possession just for resting your heel on the red paint.
Exactly. It's a staggering difference in how the game is officiated.
Okay, what about tipping the puck out of midair? We have all seen dramatic playoff goals reviewed for 10 minutes and then waved off for a high stick. Where is the actual physical threshold?
Once again, it entirely depends on which rulebook your league uses.
Mm-hmm.
In the NHL, the IIHF, and Hockey Canada, a puck contacting your stick above the normal height of the crossbar of the goal net is deemed a high stick, and the goal is disallowed.
So it's about the stick, not the hands.
Right. Crucially, the determining factor is where the puck actually makes physical contact with the stick blade or shaft, not where your hands happen to be positioned.
But USA Hockey is different again.
Wildly different. USA Hockey Rule 621 abandons the crossbar entirely. They set the maximum legal ceiling at the height of the player's shoulder.
Shoulder height.
And their official casebook explicitly states a devastating caveat. If any part of your stick is carried above the height of the shoulders, the entire stick is considered high.
Wait, I need to apply this to a real-world scenario to make sure I grasp the disparity. Let's say a puck is fluttering through the air. I reach out and tip it downward. The puck hits my stick blade right at the exact height of my neck.
Okay, neck height.
My neck is obviously higher than the 4-foot crossbar, but it is lower than my shoulder. Is that a goal?
A tip at the height of your neck is a good legal goal in the NHL, the IIHF, and Hockey Canada. That exact same play is immediately waved off as no goal in USA Hockey.
That is a massive game-altering difference based solely on geography and lead affiliation. Okay, one more rulebook nightmare before we move on. Goaltender interference involving physical contact. I am going to play the confused learner here because this always baffles me.
Sure, set it up.
Let's say I am doing my job perfectly. I am standing my ground completely outside the blue paint. But the goalie decides to aggressively challenge the shooter. They come flying out of the crease and initiate physical contact with me. Who gets the penalty?
If you are standing outside the crease and the goalie is not actively trying to play the puck with their stick, they are not granted fair game immunity. If a goalie initiates unnecessary contact with a player established outside the crease, the goalie can be penalized.
Okay, that makes sense.
But if this happens inside the crease, NHL Rule 69.3 is absolutely ruthless to the attacker. If a goaltender is attempting to establish their position inside their own crease and they initiate contact with you, you must immediately give ground and vacate the space.
Hold on. If the goalie is the one who skates into me and hits me, I have to move.
Even if they hit you, the crease is their absolute domain. If they hit you and you obstinately hold your ground and a goal is scored through the ensuing scramble, the goal will be disallowed for interference, and you will likely find yourself sitting in the penalty box for 2 minutes.
Okay, let's pause here. That was a lot of legal jargon. Let's summarize the golden rules of the net front for long-term memory reinforcement.
Good idea.
If you are going to the net, live just beyond the painted arc. Keep your stick blade glued to the ice. If the goalie pushes you while you are in the paint, surrender the ground immediately. And for the love of the game, read your specific league's rule book to know if your high stick limit is the crossbar or your shoulder.
That is the perfect summary. The net front is where offensive plays finish, but we need to discuss where they start.
Right. Where do they usually start?
The vast majority of offensive possessions are orchestrated from one of two locations: the winger's home base on the half wall, or Wayne Gretzky's legendary office behind the net. Let's map out these two critical attack hubs.
Let's start with the half wall. Geographically, this is the area along the sideboards that is roughly level with the faceoff dot. Why is this prime real estate?
Because the boards protect your back so you don't have to worry about getting hit from behind, you have a panoramic view of the entire offensive zone, and you are positioned exactly equidistant from four entirely different tactical plays.
Exactly. When you receive the puck on the half wall and get your head up, you have four distinct avenues of attack. Option one is low. You pass the puck down the wall, into the corner, or behind the net.
which feeds the cycle we talked about earlier and maintains safe, low-risk possession.
Option two is high. You pass the peck backward up to the defenseman at the point,
initiating the low-to-high sequence to generate a point shot with traffic.
Option three is the middle, attempting the seam pass across the Royal Road. This is the highest expected value, but also the highest risk of interception.
And option four is yourself. Mm-hmm. If your defending checker is flat-footed or gives you too much space, you use your own feet to drive the net or cut sharply into the high slot for a shot.
So you have four options. What is the ultimate failure state for a player arriving on the half wall?
The ultimate failure is arriving at the half wall with only one option preloaded in your mind. If you catch the puck having already pre-decided, I am going to pass to the point, you will blindly throw the puck to the point, even if the high-value seam pass across the slot is wide open.
You are playing on autopilot.
You must scan the middle option first. You check the Royal Road. If it's closed, then you evaluate the high, low, or yourself options.
And what if I check the middle, but I need an extra second for a passing lane to develop?
You have to buy time, but you must do it while keeping your feet moving. You can execute a cutback, aggressively skating back up the wall against the defender's momentum, or you can delay and curl, pulling the puck away from the defender into open ice toward the blue line.
But whatever evasive maneuver you choose, we return to the physical rule of the cycle. Never, ever turn your back to the boards.
Exactly. Keep your vision up.
Now, let's move downward to the second attack hub behind the net, the ultimate vantage point. A lot of amateur teams treat ending up behind the net as a failure, a dead end where the puck just gets stuck and the play dies.
That is a severe misunderstanding of zone geometry. Behind the net is actually an elite, highly coveted attacking position.
Why is it so good?
Think about the sight lines. When you stand behind the goal line with the puck, you are looking up the ice at all five defending players and the goaltender. You can see the entire chessboard.
Wow, yeah.
Conversely, the defense is forced to play with their backs turned to their own net, constantly swiveling their heads to track both you and the attackers in the slot.
It is a geometric nightmare for the goalie, too. Every single time the puck crosses the imaginary line behind the net from left to right, the goalie has to physically turn their head, completely lose their squareness to the ice, and make a split-second decision about which post they need to seal. It induces panic.
And let's inject some hard data to back this up. Returning to the passing project data, passes that originate from below the goal line and go into the slot are the second most dangerous pass measured in the sport.
Converting at what rate?
Converting at 6.73%. Why is it so high? Because a pass from behind the net out to a shooter in the slot crosses the Royal Road almost by definition. You are forcing the goal to push off the post and move forward and laterally at the same time.
Okay, I am sold. I am feeling pretty confident behind the net, and physically it feels safe. Nobody can come at me directly from behind because the end boards are literally inches from my back. I am protected. So, am I invincible back there? Can I just hang out, sip coffee, and map the ice all day?
I have to warn you incredibly heavily about confusing geometric advantage with physical immunity.
Okay, hit me.
It is fundamentally true that a defender can only pressure you from the left or the right side, and checking a player from behind is a major penalty with severe consequences across all rule books. But do not let that lull you into a false sense of security.
Because they can still hit you.
Players still get violently driven into the rigid metal goal frame back there. They get sandwiched between two converging defenders. Do not sit there and admire your perceived safety. You must keep your head up on a swivel and know exactly which defender is arriving to flesh you out.
That is a very necessary safety tip. So we have discussed at length how to operate when we are fully set up in the zone. We know the geometry. But what happens in the exact chaotic moment the puck actually leaves the stick for a shot, or the moment we first cross the blue line? The machine isn't static. It has to deal with transitions.
This takes us into the critical realms of the golden window and risk management.
The golden window. I want to highlight a section of the sources labeled the most dangerous 3 seconds. The analysts looked at the NHL's public play-by-play data feed for the 2024-25 regular season. They calculated a baseline. At any random moment in an offensive possession, a team scores a goal 0.26% of the time.
Okay.
But they found that if a team manages to put a shot on goal, they score again within the next 3 seconds 1.37% of the time.
Let's emphasize what that math means. It means that teams score roughly 5 times more often in that specific microscopic 3-second window following an initial shot than they do at any other point in the game. In fact, An astonishing 11.4% of all goals scored in the entire league occurred within 3 seconds of a preceding shot.
It is pure distilled chaos. The shot comes in, the goalie drops to their knees to make the save, rebounds are bouncing off shin pads, the defending players are all puck watching, completely losing their assignments. The structure of the defense evaporates.
But here's the tragedy. This 3-second window of maximum vulnerability is also the exact moment that most amateur teams simply start playing hockey.
It is a catastrophic habit. The shot happens and everyone on the ice just stands up straight, coasts on their skates, and watches to see if the puck went in.
So how should the 5-man machine react in those 3 seconds?
Right, what's the plan?
It requires absolute pre-programmed discipline. While the two lowest forwards, F1 and F2, must instantly hunt the net, crashing the crease with violent intent for rebounds and tips, the F3 player, the highest forward in the attack triangle, has a completely different ultimate responsibility. F3 must lock down the safety position near the top of the faceoff circles.
Why is F3's role so critical in that moment of chaos? Why shouldn't they crash the net too?
Because if a long rebound squirts out high into the slot, F3 is the only player on the ice with forward momentum who can step into it for a secondary shot. Conversely, if the goaltender makes the save and the defense manages to sweep the puck out toward the blue line, F3 is literally the only thing standing in the way of a devastating odd-man counterattack.
F3 is the failsafe.
Furthermore, F3 has to monitor the defenseman. If a defenseman decides to pinch to keep the puck in, F3 has to instantly cover their abandoned position at the blue line.
Ugh, the defenseman's tinch. The ultimate gamble. Deciding when to aggressively step down the wall to intercept a clearing attempt and keep the puck trapped in the offensive zone. What is the absolute golden rule for executing a pinch?
The mantra every defenseman must memorize is this: if you can't arrive on contact, don't go. When you decide to pinch, you must be mathematically certain that you will reach the puck or the opposing player receiving the puck at the exact same fraction of a second they do.
Because if you're late...
If you arrive even a single beat late, the opposing winger will simply chip the puck past you off the glass. You have now taken yourself completely out of the play, and you are looking at a 2-on-1 rush going the other way.
And a successful pinch isn't just evaluated on whether you win the puck. It's about risk mitigation. It's about what happens if you fail.
Exactly. A great defenseman runs a checklist before they ever jump a lane. They ask themselves, is my defensive partner holding the middle of the ice to protect the center lane? Is F3 rotating up to cover my vacated spot at the point? If the answers are no, you cannot pinch, no matter how juicy the puck looks.
And if you do pinch and fail.
Crucially, if you do pinch and you fail to win the puck, you never, ever retreat straight backward down the sideboards. You must immediately retreat laterally into the center slot to reestablish your gap control and protect the most dangerous ice.
It sounds like F3 and the pinching defenseman are essentially sitting on opposite ends of a seesaw. If the defenseman goes down the wall, their weight pulls the seesaw down, which means F3 must go up to the blue line to maintain the balance of the machine.
That is a brilliant integrated mental model. The seesaw is a perfect way to visualize it. They are completely tethered to one another by invisible geometry. If the seesaw breaks, the machine fails.
Now, there is a massive safety warning in the sources regarding the physical execution of the pinch. We have to address this because it is dangerous.
It concerns the defenseless player. You must never execute a high-speed pinch to physically hit an opposing winger who is facing the glass and trying to dig the puck out with their skates.
If they are facing the glass, they cannot see you coming. They are completely defenseless.
NHL Rule 41.1, which governs boarding, puts the onus entirely on the hitting player to avoid or minimize contact if the opponent is in a vulnerable position. Driving your shoulder into a player's back when they are 2 feet from the boards is how careers end.
It is a major penalty and an automatic game misconduct across almost all rule books, from the NHL down to youth leagues. So the tactical advice is, play the puck aggressively, use your body to seal the wall, but do not obliterate a player who has no way to protect themselves.
Achieving this level of coordination, knowing instantly when to pinch, when F3 must cover, how to transition from a cycle to a low-to-high play, requires a team to be incredibly well-rounded. A truly elite team must possess dual identities.
The sources call this the dichotomy of offense. Let's contrast them.
Attacking off the rush is entirely about speed, exploiting numerical advantages like a 3-on-2, and trying to strike the net within a tiny 3 to 4 second window before the opposing defense can set up their structure.
While a set possession, which we have spent most of our time discussing, is about patience, continuous geometric movement, and waiting for the defense to succumb to physical and mental exhaustion.
The critical insight here is that a team that only possesses one of these identities is incredibly easy for a smart coach to shut down.
Because if you only play off the rush,
a structured defense will simply stand you up at the blue line and force you to dump the puck, and you will have no idea what to do next. Conversely, if you only know how to cycle, you will never threaten the net quickly enough to catch the goalie moving.
But there's one specific unique moment in a hockey game where you get to perfectly blend these two concepts. It is a set possession, but you start with the puck exactly where you want it. It is the only moment where you can arrange all five of your players on the ice exactly how the coach drew it up on the whiteboard.
The offensive zone faceoff. It is essentially a choreographed set piece. It is the closest thing hockey has to a free kick in soccer or a baseline inbound play in basketball.
And it drives me crazy because most amateur teams completely waste it. They just line up, hope the center wins it, and then react to whatever happens. Let's talk tactics for the offensive faceoff. What are the high value plays?
If you have a dominant center, you have options. You can script a play to win the puck straight back to the defenseman at the point for an immediate, heavily screened shot. You can win it cleanly backward to a winger who is pre-aligned for a blistering one-timer. Or if the opposing center is strong, you can simply have your center tie up the opponent's stick, creating a stalemate, and have your wingers slash through the circle to sweep the loose puck toward the net.
But the real secret to winning an offensive zone faceoff over the course of a long season, according to the tactical sources, is counterintuitive. The secret is having a rigid structure for the loss.
Which sounds pessimistic.
I'm not going to lie, that sounds incredibly pessimistic. Why are we planning to fail?
Because it is statistically realistic. Even the best faceoff men in the NHL only win about 55 to 60% of their draws. You have to assume, mathematically, that you will lose 50% of all offensive zone faceoffs.
And if you have a plan?
If your team has a coordinated, rehearsed plan for losing meaning the moment the puck goes to the opponent, one forward instantly sprints to pressure the puck carrier, the other forwards immediately turn and skate to their defensive assignments, and the defensemen know exactly how to hold the blue line without getting burned. It changes the entire psychology of the play.
I see. It removes the fear.
Exactly. Knowing that the team is fully prepared to handle a loss actually gives your center the psychological confidence to be highly aggressive and try risky, high-reward moves on the draw. They aren't terrified of making a mistake.
It goes back to the soccer analogy. If it's a corner kick in soccer and half the team doesn't know the playbook, you aren't running a set piece. You are just giving the ball away in a highly dangerous area. Every single player must know their exact assignment, both if they win and if they lose, before the referee even drops the puck.
Okay, we have covered a massive expanse of tactical ice today. We have gone from the macro theories of expected goals down to the microphysics of a stick blade deflecting a puck. Let's bring all these disparate pieces together for a final cohesive synthesis.
Let's connect the dots and build the final mental model for the listener. Based on everything we've read, the offensive zone is a machine. Its entire overarching purpose is to force the defense into a mistake that creates a royal road pass or a chaotic screen shot from inside home plate.
The grinding cycle on the boards, the low to high point shots, the cat and mouse game on the half wall, these are not individual isolated events. They are all just interconnected gears turning, working together to force the goaltender out of position.
To solidify this, let's highlight the top 10 high-value concepts that our listeners need to retain permanently. If you forget the exact percentages, but remember these 10 principles, you will view the offensive zone with an entirely different level of clarity.
Number one, when you get the puck, look across the middle of the ice, the Royal Road, before you look up the safe wall.
Number two, point shots require heavy traffic. Without a physical screen in front of the goalie, a point shot is essentially a turnover.
Number three, F1, F2, and F3 are fluid roles based purely on who arrives first, second, and third. They are not fixed roster positions. Your job is to keep the structural attack triangle intact.
Number four, the cycle is a tool, not a destination. The cycle must eventually attack the net. Do not cycle aimlessly just for the sake of looking busy.
Number five, when you are establishing a net front screen, your posture must be a strong, wide squat, and you must keep your skates entirely clear of the painted line to avoid crease violations.
Number six, know your specific rulebook. You must know if a high stick is measured at the crossbar or your shoulder, because that legal distinction dictates your entire physical tipping strategy.
Number 7. The 3 seconds immediately post-shot are statistically the most dangerous in the entire game.
Yeah.
Do not stand up and watch, hunt the rebound violently, or lock down the high safety position.
Number 8. As a defenseman on the blue line, execute a pinch only if you are mathematically certain you can arrive on contact.
Number 9. The space behind the net is an elite, geometrically devastating attacking hub, not a dead end where plays go to die.
Number 10. Always have a coordinated 5-man plan for losing the offensive zone faceoff.
When you look at those 10 points, you realize the difference between how a novice and an expert mentally organize the game. A beginner gets into the offensive zone and simply chases the little black piece of rubber. They play a frantic, exhausting game of reaction.
And the expert.
But an expert ignores the chaos. They map the geometry of the zone. They aren't looking at the puck. They're constantly tracking where their F3 safety valve is, where the seam across the Royal Road is about to open, and exactly where the goaltender's eyes are currently looking. They are playing a high-speed game of spatial anticipation.
Which brings me to a final provocative thought for everyone listening to Mull Over. The next time you watch a hockey game, I want to issue you a challenge. For one entire shift, do not watch the puck. I know it's hard, but force your eyes away from it. Watch the player who is furthest from the puck in the offensive zone. Are they just floating around aimlessly? Or can you see them silently mapping the Royal Road, adjusting their angle, waiting for that one tiny half-second window to open up? Because that invisible geometry, that space away from the puck, is where the game is actually won.
It completely changes how you see the sport. It stops being a game of brute force and becomes a game of chess played at 30 miles an hour.
It really does. So much for just bombarding the castle walls with pucks, right?
The siege mentality is dead.
Ooh.
Long live the surgical strike. That concludes this deep dive into the offensive zone. You are now armed with an expert mental model. Use it well.